Then we'll move on to item eight, consider and take possible action to adopt the declining employer payroll actuarial funding policy.
So outside of Sosera, there have been some employers over time that have experienced a declining employer payroll. And here at Sosera, we thought that it would be prudent to take a proactive measure in looking at adopting a policy so that if we had a declining employer who had a declining payroll, that we would have some guidelines and procedures around what that would look like and what we would do in those instances. So today, we have for the board's consideration a declining employer payroll actual funding policy, and Paul from Siegel is here to talk about it a little more.
Thank you, Gail. Good morning, members of the board.
Oh, and before we go on, I did want to mention that currently we're not aware of any Sosera participating employers that this situation would apply to.
Right. And we even put that on the slide, so we will emphasize that. This is very much a proactive policy. Let's see here. So these slides are a little bit dense, but this is almost like having a report on the topic. Walks through what the real issues are. Currently the question is, what happens under your current policy? You have a policy for terminating employers, where you have a nice clean action where an employer says, we are going to take our future folks to CalPERS, and take our liabilities to CalPERS, or some way end their participation. And you are also I think you're the only system we know of that has both what we call an ongoing. This is, and you have, John, tell me some of the cities. City of Pittsburgh,
City of Pittsburgh, yep, that's one of them.
These are employers who withdrew, but they remain at risk. Mm-hmm. And so they said, every time you do an experience study, you can remeasure our liabilities as well. This is the City of Pittsburgh talking. Right. And if our liability goes up, we'll pay for it. So they're still actually making contributions. In that situation, they get the advantage of using your risky discount rate. Risky means it's not risk-free. You also have, and this is what you may have read about at CalPERS. At CalPERS, if you withdraw, they don't allow this ongoing risk relationship. If you withdraw, then they want you to write a check today that will protect the system from any future losses. That's the so-called risk-free rate. That's what the New York Times once accused CalPERS of having two sets of books. Well, you do have two sets of books. You have one value for employers that remain at risk, and a different, much more conservative assumption for employers that are no longer at risk. What's different here at CSERA is you actually give your employers that choice. So that's what you have now. This is a different situation. And I will tell you, this originated, and Harvey Lederman's here. We have a client in common, Orange County. They were, to our knowledge, the first system in California to develop this so-called declining employer situation. What they had was two employers who decided to put their future members into CalPERS, and so they weren't adding any more active members. Well, the key here is, right now, and this is the fourth bullet down, when you have employers in a pool together, the way that we allocate the share of the unfunded liability contribution, how much of the unfunded does each employer pay within a rate group, it's in proportion to payroll. Well, if you have an employer that has actives and retireds, and they don't put any new actives in, so the active count goes down, so the payroll goes down, their share of the unfunded goes down in proportion to payroll. And in one case, it went down to zero. That doesn't mean this employer doesn't still have an unfunded liability. But what it means is the way that we allocate the unfunded presumes that everybody's going to stay in the same proportion of payroll. And the moment that fails, you need a new policy. So that's what this was invented for. Again, the most typical example would be an employer stops contracting for new employees, and so the current employees continue to accrue future service. There just aren't any new ones coming in. So by attrition, the active group goes down. But you could also have a system that simply stops hiring new employees. If you had a district or an agency that for whatever reason is kind of going out of business, well, you'd see the same declining payroll and therefore this shift away from them having to fund the unfunded. So we have a couple systems around the state that are looking at this policy. You are one of them. I want to emphasize the point that Gail made, that we are not aware that you have any currently declining employers, so we're getting the policy in effect before we actually have a situation where it would apply. And by the way, again, if we'll take questions as we go through here. So this is where we talk about how we do it. For ongoing employers, the unfunded UAAL, unfunded actuarial accrued liability payment, is in proportion to payroll. It assumes a constant active headcount. And then from our assumptions, we assume payroll is going to grow at 3.25%. For an employer with a declining active headcount, the payroll reduces over time. That means that 3.25% payroll growth, that's not happening anymore, which means they're basically shifting out of making contributions. So the idea of the policy is to ensure that even these employees with declining payroll will continue to pay their fair share of the unfunded liability. So what we do is, first of all, this would be in the future. And what the policy does first is it defines something called a triggering event. And you will see in this policy, we're very careful not to have bright lines. We don't say, for example, that in order for it to be a triggering event, payroll has to decrease by 20% of pay. Because the next thing you know, here comes somebody with 19% of pay, and is that so there's a judgment call here. So the first thing is identifying what the triggering event is. And then if you're no longer going to allocate the unfunded payment in proportion to payroll, well, what are you going to use as the basis? So those are the two things. We have other systems, Orange, Kern, and Alameda, that have either looked at or have adopted these policies. So let's start with the triggering event. And this is described in the policy. It's all spelled out. There's really roughly two types of triggering events. First is if an employer ceases to enroll new employees in CSERA. Okay, and that was the example that we had down in Orange County. And the other one is, and it's described, you know, the words used are, it experiences a material and expected to be long-lasting reduction in CSERA-covered payroll. That's the one that's subjective. We don't have a triggering percentage, and that is something that if it's identified as you do your sort of, you know, internal audits of your employers, we would review it with staff. And then decide whether it's worth bringing to the board for consideration as a triggering event. So we would work with you, like it says there, we'd bring it to see if that's occurred. If there's some timing stuff in the policy, if a triggering event has occurred, then generally we would go back to the previous valuation date, and that's where we would then reallocate the assets and the liabilities to that employer. And then we would do a word that's well known around here, we would depool. Now, you already have a lot of employers that are in their own pool. If one of those employers had a triggering event, well, you wouldn't need to depool them because they're already depooled. You wouldn't need to reallocate their liabilities because they already have only their own liabilities in their pool. So all that you would see is that we would restructure the amortization payments. That's coming up. Okay. So once you've identified the triggering event, you need to decide how to allocate the unfunded, and how to structure the payments. Currently, we allocate by payroll. The thing about payroll is, if you have two employers with the same headcount, same active headcount, and same, say they each have 100 employees, but one of them has 100 retirees, the other one has 200 retirees, well, they're both basically paying the same share of the unfunded, which means there's a subsidy between those two. The one with the fewer retirees is actually subsidizing the one with more retirees. The moment you have a triggering event, we would look at the actual liability of each employer. So they would then get their own unsubsidized share. So that would be the policy recommendation. Then the thing about the amortization payments, right now we amortize them as a level percent of pay, assuming that pay will go up at 3.25% per year. Well, that's not going to work anymore. So we would actually go to a more classic level dollar type of amortization.
Paul, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
You mentioned, I just wanted to rewind the tape about 30 seconds. If you had two similarly situated employers, both with 100 active, but you have one with 100 retirees, the other with 200, have you actually been through the experience where that depooling resulted in the unsubsidized shift, and how did that play?
Well, I'm gonna let John throw some details. We went through a huge project here in Contra Costa about depooling. How many years ago was that, John? Probably five-ish?
No, it was like before it was time. Over 10 years ago.
Time flies when you're having fun. We actually went through that process, and we identified that we had employers that used to be pooled, and when we depooled them, one cost went up, one cost went down. I don't know that it was as radical a difference as, you know, 100 to 200 retirees. But we had here in Contra Costa, as an action, as a deliberate action by the board to separate the larger employers into their own pools, we went through it there. I've not seen for this declining employer policy, well, it turns out we're actually working on a case that they have an employer that's gone through a triggering event. And it was identified that for that employer, they were actually in a pool with the county, and they have, like, you know, 100 people, and the county has 10,000 people. But it turns out the county in this pool has fewer retirees than active, so more actives than retirees, whereas this little employer, it was upside down. So that was a case where, yeah, we did see there was some internal subsidy, but that's the nature of pooling. But here at Contra Costa, we did that on a large scale across the plan, again, about 10 years ago. Is that responsive to your question?
Yeah, I was assuming that, but trying to think of if you had employers in the same pool who were not similarly situated, i.e. there's a cross subsidy within the pool,
right,
and then this circumstance arises based on this policy, how does that play in the final analysis for the previously subsidized employer who now finds themselves unsubsidized?
That would hurt. Okay. I mean, somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose.
Yeah, so I was asking, had you had any experience with that hurt?
Well, again, we have an open case right now where that hurt is there, and there's some question. It's a somewhat different fact pattern, because in this case, the employer is not going down to no actives. They had a one-time drop from 100 actives to 70 actives. And the question is, can we accomplish the purpose of this policy without depooling? Because the depooling would have hurt them. That is very much their own fact pattern. Here, if you have an employer that's moving toward having no actives, if they have a subsidy, they're going to lose it. And if it was going the other way, if they were subsidizing the rest of the group, then they would get an advantage. But I think that when you have an employer that's not ongoing, the whole concept of pooling becomes difficult to defend.
Right.
Yeah. But we don't do this on any presumption that it's going to go one way or the other. But whatever subsidy, in whatever direction, if you have an employer that's going down to no actives, they're basically going to now get charged their own experience.
So this strikes me, though, as a very general set of policy guidelines to what is always in each case going to be an incredibly fact-sensitive situation. It sounds like that.
I'm going to say almost. I think that, and again, it turned out we have an employer where they had two agencies that stopped putting new members into the plan. Those two are actually very similar fact patterns. That is, if you have a situation where an agency is not putting new actives in, That's going to look pretty similar from case to case. And in every case, we believe it will indicate strongly that you need to depool. Now, whether they win or lose will be fact-based, but I would submit that shouldn't necessarily be what you base the decision on. If you're no longer being an ongoing employer, you need to carry your own weight, whether that is heavier or lighter than the weight that you're currently carrying.
Yeah, I guess I was reacting to, it's probably a few slides ago, the threshold determination. If someone has a declining employment payroll, quote, and is not expected to recover, i.e. it's going to be long life, that's a decision that we would make under this policy, correct?
Yes, sir. That one is always going to be, which slide is that one on, John? Let me go back.
But that's the threshold decision that gets you into the doom.
This is going to be facts and circumstances. This one is pretty clear cut. If they stop enrolling new actives, you're
Got
going
it.
Down.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
This one, absolutely, Scott. This one is going to be fact-based every time. In this particular case, that one-time drop was a 22% drop. And the board hasn't decided yet, because we're still open, but that we believe the board will conclude that constituted a material and expected long-lasting. If it went down 2%, I don't know. But so it could be a gray line.
Yeah, and I'm asking in part because we had an employer in recent years who suffered a decline in active payroll, but and I'm not certain that I knew what their long-term prognosis was. They came back, right? But that was a circumstance that could have triggered that second bullet analysis.
I think what it does, it triggers the conversation. It doesn't necessarily trigger the conclusion.
Right. Okay, fair enough.
Harvey? So to that extent, isn't the first bullet also fact-related as well? I mean, there are all kinds of different circumstances here, but we have some very small employers,
right.
employers right. who in some cases may not have added someone over the course of a year.
Right.
Is that a triggering event simply because they didn't have a vacancy or didn't add a new person?
Well, remember, not adding is the issue. It's that somebody leaves and they're not replaced. Right? Remember, we're assuming constant headcount. You don't have to churn as long as you got the same headcount.
But that's not exactly what the first bullet point says.
It says. You
may not have added anyone new during that year. No one left, but you didn't add anything new because the sponsoring agency is so small and their headcount is static.
Okay, so that sentence, I get the distinction. That sentence presumes that you have new hires. The sentence says you have new hires and you're not enrolling them in CSERA. That's the bright line triggering event. Okay. If you don't enroll anybody because you don't have anybody, that's status quo. No, this is that's a fair question. The presumption in that bullet is that you have new hires and you are no longer enrolling them in CSERA. That's the bright line.
So is it reasonable to assume that CSERA would have knowledge of that?
Hope so.
No, I mean, but you've got...
You've got 100 employees, and we
find out how that they now have 105 and the five newest weren't enrolled in CSERA.
Well, this gets into, and again, I'm going to defer to Gail. This gets into what level of sort of internal audit you do for your employers. The idea is if you go poke around your employers and you find out they have new hires they didn't enroll, well, for one thing, I'll defer to counsel. I mean, is that even legally allowed? If you're a contracting employer, are you allowed to cherry pick? So now they've breached their contract. We're not going to enforce that for you, but you would need to have some sort of enforcement mechanism.
Right.
For
that. It would have to be part of us. If they're not voluntarily reporting it, we're going to have to be able to determine that.
Yes. But that, again, that's an internal audit function. That's really not what this policy would address.
Right.
Yeah. Can I ask about the what happens after a triggering event is identified? So the first bullet of the last arrow, you go back to the last actuarial evaluation date.
Right.
Is that cemented in policy, or let's say there's some long pattern of decline and you realize that over 5 years or something, 10 years, the active headcount has decreased by 15% or so.
That's a great question. We're just checking to see what the policy latitude is here in the policy.
So we recognize the event long after it's happened,
right.
or halfway through it.
Right. Right. Well, the good news is, though, is when you do this reallocation, the reallocation is based upon the actives and inactives today. So as long as you do the reallocation today, including everyone who's around today, all you're going to miss is if there was someone who retired some years ago and has since died and is no longer part of the liability, we don't go back to pick that up. But we are picking up anything that has happened through today. What's the latitude as far as that going back a year?
Well, I mean, the policy a triggering event, the fact that a triggering event may have occurred in the past does not prevent the retirement association from applying the policy to that employer. So if it turns out that that looking at the facts and circumstances that the triggering event occurred 5 years ago, I mean, we can go back to 5 years ago and to that valuation date and do the calculation, you know. So I think that that's possible.
And I think that's what I'm trying to find. I'm looking for in the proposed policy where it talks about which valuation we're going to use.
That's on page 4. The actuary will use the actual valuation performed as of the end of the calendar year immediately prior to the calendar year in which the triggering event occurs.
Okay. So that is stated as somewhat definitive. I think that with any policy, and again, deferring to counsel, with any policy, if you had a situation where there was a commanding reason to go back to some earlier date as the valuation date, you could do that. But I think the policy here is saying even if the triggering event happened a long time ago, you're really only going to go back to the last valuation when it's time to reallocate the unfunded.
Well, so, I think when you think about the effectiveness of this policy, it makes sense to include that in there, because sometimes there will be instances where, you know, the employer says, okay, we're going to stop, you know, new, like that first instance, you know, stop enrolling new hires. They're going to give you that heads up in advance.
Right.
But a lot of times it's going to be because we're reviewing things and seeing, oh my gosh, you know, 8 months ago it dropped. Let's take a look at this. Okay, it looks like over whatever period it's dropped, you know, and that's where we also have that long-lasting reduction in payroll. It has to have already occurred for us to be able to make that determination, hey, let's review this.
Right.
So, it makes sense that we have that in policy.
Right. But I also think you take some comfort in the fact that, and we did, working with staff, looked around to see whether we think we have any of these today. So we don't think that we're going to have a situation where we identify that a triggering event occurred some years ago. And that maybe is why we have a little more confidence saying that when we find one, we'll only have to go back to the previous valuation to do the allocation. But that is, yeah, we're somewhat counting on the fact that you don't have a sleeper out there that we have not yet identified. In that case, you're right. You could argue that you maybe need to go further back. But even then, as long as we capture the liability for everybody today, I think that actually does at least make the other employers protected on a going forward basis.
Okay. Harvey, did you still have something?
Well, I just want to make some clarity and give maybe a couple of examples of the design of these two bullet points on triggering events from real situations that might make it clear. What you have is, in some instances, the employer says, we're going to enroll new hires from now on in CalPERS. We're getting out of CICERA. That's a new hire. So that's one triggering event. Because since we translate their contributions into a percentage of payroll, if their payroll changes and goes down, then their percentage of payroll is not paying for their unfunded liability. We had that in Orange County, where somebody stopped enrolling people, and all they had left were retirees in OSERS, and they had no payroll. And so they said, well, we have no unfunded liability any longer for our retirees because we have no payroll. You know, our employer contributions are supposed to be 15% of payroll. 15% is 0-0, we're not paying them. They thought their liability went away. That's what that is designed to do. The other thing is when the employer says, we're taking our existing employees and for their future service, we're going to PERS. We're going to enroll them in PERS. But they will still have CICERA-covered service and therefore liabilities in CICERA. And that's meant to be... Okay, what we tried to avoid in the design, and that's why we say material and expected long-lasting, is you remember 10 years ago, we went through a period of time where all employers had put a freezing hire in or a furlough, were furloughing people, and those were not, and we actually talked about at that time whether people's compensation earnable, their pensionable compensation, should be based on their frozen salaries or their reduced salaries. And we said, no, those were temporary. That's going to come back. And they're going to come back to full-time work. So we're not going to change their pensionable compensation. And that's the same idea here. We don't want to look at an employer and say, well, for a year or two, your payroll's going down, and so we're going to call that a trigger event. We want to distinguish that from someone who says, I'm not enrolling any more people in your system. That's a triggering event. Or we've farmed out our firefighting services to another agency, and so we're not going to be putting any more services. So that would be a triggering event, not a temporary change. So that's, you know, there are real experiences that have come about. We had it in Fresno as well. We went through this with the mm-hmm. North Central Fire District, mm-hmm. who said that they were taking all their people out and no longer incurring Fresno County service. That was a triggering event. In that case, working with Siegel, we developed a risk-free cost and sent them the bill for that, and they paid it, money for it. But those are the kind of triggering events that would come to the board, and the board would say, you know what, this looks like a material long-term change in enrollment and payroll, so we're going to have to calculate their unfunded liability on something other than a percentage of payroll, because their covered payroll is not going to be there anymore.
Very good. Okay.
That's helpful.
So, yeah, so again, the two questions, triggering event, and then you know, how you do the allocation. And again, this is actually fairly straightforward because we can always measure the liability because it's measured one human at a time, retireds and actives. And then what we would say, instead of allocating in proportion to payroll, we would allocate the assets in the pool in proportion to liability. In effect, instead of assuming that all employers have the same unfunded contribution rate, we'd be assuming that all employers had the same funded ratio. And admittedly, this gets to your question, it might be if you did that 5 years ago, you might get a different proportion. But since this is somewhat forward-looking, we basically take the snapshot as of the previous valuation and say, and so now your active to retired proportion would be directly reflected in the level of assets that are allocated to you and therefore the unfunded liability that's allocated to you. So that's pretty clear-cut recommendation from our standpoint. And then as far as structuring the payments, again, you can't very well do a percentage of a level percentage of an increasing payroll if your payroll is going down. So we basically shift it to a home mortgage, and it becomes level dollar. Now remember, this employer is not walking away. This is not the one where we have to use the risk-free discount rate. So the idea is that we would continue. This is the next slide, I think. So this employer would, you know, they would still be part of the valuation. We would have a cost group called terminated employers. And so that means that, for example, if there are gain, if they have assets, the assets are not invested separately, right? The assets are pooled. So if there is a loss on investments, they would get a loss on investments as well. So they would actually still get new amortization layers. You know, so the initial layer would be the one that's created when they depool. With that reallocation in proportion to liability, but then they would still be participating in the ongoing experience of the plan. Now, if it ever happened that you start thinking that employer is not actually creditworthy going forward, well, this is where you already have a withdrawing employer policy that allows you to use the risk-free discount rate. So this is where the two policies would sort of, you could hand the employer off from the declining employer policy over to the termination policy. But this is principally designed right now for employers that are still ongoing, they're still viable entities. The only thing that's happened is they're no longer putting active members into CSERA.
Paul, as you've trained us well on 18 years, which clearly makes good, makes good sense when we're talking about the percentage being applied against an increasing future payroll. Now we're going to flat dollar. Why stay at 18? Why not 15, for example?
I think the policy gives discretion to the board.
Yeah, the policy says over a period not to exceed 18.
Not
years.
To exceed 18. Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. So there's no negative amp.
Yeah, not to exceed 18.
Okay.
Now again, you know, when you do this, we don't know for sure where the subsidy is, but when you do the reallocation, and if in fact they were subsidized, so now suddenly they have a bigger unfunded liability, so that increases their cost, and you move them to level dollar, that increases their cost. I don't sound too glib. You could pile on and also shorten the amortization period, but the policy says you could let them stay at the 18 that the other employers enjoy.
But we're not using the risk-free rate.
No, sir. Because they are still
a huge difference.
Yeah, because they are still at risk.
Right.
They are still at risk, and that's what's key here. The new layers are amortized, but they must. This is key, right? They must be expected to continue as a financially viable agency. And that is stated in the policy.
Right. One thing to keep in mind, too, is that if we do pull out an employer and create a new cost group, whatever employers were in that previous cost group will be impacted by that action as well. You know, their rates are going to change as well with this action.
And you can just imagine a situation where you had an employer, the one who happens to be declining, and maybe they were the ones subsubsidizing others.
Well, that's why my earlier question, I was trying to understand.
If it happens, I mean, standalone means standalone. Yeah, but you're right. It could impact the cost for the other employers as well. Okay, and that's all our slides.
Paul, I have a couple questions, actually.
Yeah.
With the example of Cost Group 8, which is Contra Costa County Fire and East Contra Costa, you have the small and the large employers.
Mm-hmm.
How is the cost group, how does it work in terms of the pension obligation bond that Contra Costa Fire applied, I think back in 2003-ish or so?
Mm-hmm.
How does that affect the percent of payroll in terms of per, you know, how is it divvied up? Or is it only going to the members of Contra Costa County Fire, or does it go to the entire cost group?
I will throw that to John, but I just want to stress that is, in a sense, outside today's discussion. That's an ongoing issue because neither of those are declining, but we do adjust for that. John, why don't you walk us through
that? Yeah, I mean, when the pension obligation bond is initially deposited, I mean, there is a credit that solely goes to Contra Costa Fire Protection District. Okay, now what can happen over time is there can be gains or losses on that pension obligation bond. Okay?
On the assets.
All the assets, and the bond is part of those assets. Now, that currently gets split across the whole cost group.
Mm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Well, and with that, because I was looking at our rates, what is the distinction? We've got under general, we've got Contra Costa County Fire Protection District under general, and then we have safety. Is that our non-safety employees of Contra Costa Fire? And
correct.
I'm going back to page 21. Is that what that is?
I believe so, John.
Well, there's a few different, Contra Costa Fire Protection District has
right.
some non-safety employees
right, we
also.
Do.
That's
I,
right.
So they're in both. They're in two different cost
that's
groups.
Right, that's right.
Well, but so to Will's point, though, when you're estimating the UAAL, the pension obligation bond from Confire is offsetting the obligation, the UAAL, I'm guessing, for East County Fire, even though they're
no,
not paying
No, it's not.
To,
no, no.
It's not?
No,
it's still
no.
separated out? By because this is just a general, and I'm looking at page 20 where you were giving us sort of estimated numbers. And so you say the normal cost is 0.79, UAL is a negative 4.85. But then when you actually get down and give Confire their numbers and East County Fire their numbers, they'd be slightly different?
The numbers are extremely different. Okay. What you're looking at is the impact of, I think, the assumption change.
Right, the assumption
change.
Has
nothing to do with
okay,
pension obligation.
Okay, that's just what
bond.
I wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
This is just sort of a general assumption, so no one should really be relying on this general assumption.
Well, that assumption will impact both East Fire and Confire the same way, okay? The impact of the assumption changes, okay? Because that is pooled across the group.
Yeah, let's be clear. The baseline cost is very different because of the pension obligation bond.
Right.
But you then come on with an assumption change. That's just adding a new layer on top. The change due to the assumptions might be the resulting new total cost is going to be very different because the baseline costs were
right.
different.
Okay.
For each employer.
Yes.
For each employer. Yeah. Okay. Another. I had three.
Right?
Do you mind? Just quick questions. Does Rodeo Hercules, because I know that at one point Rodeo Hercules, due to fiscal crisis, was granted essentially an annual payment for the UAL?
I think it wasn't
the well, they make it in.
They instead do a flat dollar.
They pay in dollars.
Percent of pay.
Yeah. Interesting. They're doing what this policy would impose on someone else.
No. It's not a level dollar amount. It's calculated as a level percent of payroll, but then it's converted into a dollar amount, and then they make dollar payments every month.
Annually or monthly or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
That's right.
So it's not how it's structured. It's just how you send them the bill.
Yep.
Okay,
that's
my mistake.
Yep.
It's not the level dollar.
And then CalPERS, I think, just recently converted all of their members to an annual payment as well. Is that correct?
They converted to, for future changes only, new layers, they are no longer using level percent of pay amortization. So the thing that we would be imposing on these declining employers, CalPERS now does that for everybody.
For everyone.
And we don't know why they did that, but they did.
Yeah, I think the disconnect with the thought here is that, you know, they don't have a annual payment. You know, it's part of payroll, so they just think, oh, we can just essentially separate and that just goes away, right? And there's that disconnect.
Yeah.
And I know
yeah.
it's a mechanism of an accounting
right.
to pay for it, but I'm wondering if, you know, it would be less a surprise to an employer that's considering leaving, understanding that they still have, you know, they're still making that annual payment. If that was kind of the course, you know, it's more of a perception thing. It's like payroll. You think they're taking away payroll. You know, so my point is in a long, sorry, Jerry.
Sorry.
Is that if our employers were paying an annual payment for a UAL, they would probably be less surprised if they were going to leave that they would still have that payment. I mean, that would be
We got two very different things. When you say making an annual payment, I'm not quite sure what that means. I mean, everybody, you're going to make an annual payment anyway. There's two things. One is, how are the payments structured? Do they start small and get big? Or are they level dollar? That's the structure of the payments. And then, once you've figured out what the current payment is, do you say, you owe us $100,000, because that's the payment, or do you take $100,000 divided by payroll and say, you should pay us a certain percentage of pay that will get you to $100,000? So those are two different things. Mm-hmm. What CalPERS did was not only to bill the employer as a dollar amount, which basically is the same cost, it's just expressed differently. But they also restructured the payment to increase the current payments for future layers. So these are two different things. I don't think that just in order to have more clarity on how the amount is paid, that you should charge them more. So you could argue that maybe we should bill the employers in dollars. But that also can complicate things. I mean, right now, the employer pays a percentage of pay, and that includes both normal cost and the unfunded. Here, what CalPERS does is they send the employer two bills. Pay us this percentage of pay, normal cost, and write us a check for this year's payment. That would not change how expensive the plan is to the employers, but it would change the way that we bill them. So that to me is more of an administrative change. A bigger policy change would be to say, we're actually going to now, you know, structure the payments as level dollar amount. That would actually cost more today. Mm-hmm. So I want to distinguish those two.
Understood. I just think in the departments that our members, employers, essentially have a hard time with the headlines regarding a percentage of payroll for the employers that have reduced their workforce significantly, and now it's 120%. Of payroll costs, when really they're paying essentially that same uh-huh. dollar amount, uh-huh. but it's just applied to, you know, it doesn't look good when you have 120%
right.
of cost for, you know, for a benefit. Mm-hmm. So
because the public doesn't know that only 12% of that is the cost for current employees' new service.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Not exactly. No. We're pretending about it. But the moment you start talking about how you structure payments, you know, it does invite that conversation. Sure.
This all makes sense to me. To what extent are we obligated, or would we want to advise the employers of this change in policy, and to also remind them what this is intended?
You're going to pay.
Well, that's right. Not as a threat, but it basically says you've got to have people enrolled. If you decide to leave, we need you to know what this policy is and what your obligations will be if you were to leave. Not suggesting you are, but if somebody gets the idea that they want to do that at a later date, here's what this means.
That's where Guido comes in.
For the record, we have no Guido.
Yeah, we don't.
That's no way to talk about Raleigh.
I think if the board adopts a policy that could potentially affect an employer in the future, we should will be communicating to employers.
I was going to say, anytime we change a policy, I think we have an obligation to tell our employers,
of course.
No matter how serious, but certainly highlight this one in particular, but again,
I just don't want to have people come back later on ever and say, we didn't know this. Now, if we send out stuff, and we send out stuff, and we also send out stuff, and they didn't read it, that's a different thing.
Well, and I would do the abbreviated version.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
The cover letter right. that says, this is only if you were ever to leave. If you were, you would still be obligated for A, B, and C. I mean, again, because we can't really expect every HR director or whoever finance person to read through it and interpret it.
Yeah. I agree.
I've read it.
Yeah, especially you don't want to just send that out, and they might think, "What? They're gonna start doing this?
Exactly. What's going on?" Yeah, no, that's why. Yeah, no,
that needs
has
to come
to be, if you ever plan to leave us, this is what you will pay us. So,
David.
It's kind of the discussion my wife had with me.
Yeah, exactly.
Right after we got married.
Too much information.
You can leave if you want, but here's the downside.
Right.
You want to try?
I want a divorce.
Done.
Okay.
You done? So if we set a new policy in place, how do we enforce it?
So you have the ability.
Raleigh.
No.
We have enforcement.
We have ways.
We got people.
We do have a Guido.
I mean,
put your sunglasses back on.
Yeah. I mean, you have funding policies, and the funding policy, the law gives you the right to set funding policies and collect contributions based on them. This would be one of your policies, and you would collect it the same way you collect the regular contributions.
Right, but if they say, well, we're not going to go for that.
Well, then they can sue us.
Okay.
And they can lose, like happened in one particular jurisdiction. I mean, Harvey, I'll defer to counsel here, but yeah.
Well, we would focus on dialogue with our employers.
There you go.
At, like what we do now. We have a support handle. We can work with
kind of like
employers and work things out.
Okay, but
we have mechanisms to collect some money.
So we don't have to rely on filing.
I'm leaving at quarter two.
That might be a last resort.
Because, I mean, it's, in reality, they could say, well, nah, you can't afford this. We're not going to save that.
They could.
I should leave now. It's too hot.
We have our ways. Yeah. I'd rather not discuss them publicly.
Okay.
Building a minute too soon.
All right.
But I think this becomes part of your funding policy, and it is enforceable on exactly the same terms as all your other funding policies. I think also, though, just in terms of reasonableness, having the policy in effect before the triggering event takes place,
yes,
you know, means, you know, with this is the, when they, if they took an action,
correct,
that triggers, if they take an action that does this, then they know that this will be the consequence.
Yeah, I just, you know, it's been in the news that there have been, CalPERS has had this experience with employers saying, we're not going to. Just wanted to double check.
Actually, the CalPERS story, number one, the CalPERS stories, there aren't a million of them. There's a handful, and each one is its own fact pattern. And CalPERS has not gotten that much resistance. I mean, they've got complaining, but for the most part, most systems have, you know, they know what the CalPERS rule is. Like, for example, the withdrawing employer you go to the risk-free discount rate, they know that in advance. Each CalPERS employer has that number in their actuarial report. So they can't say, well, we withdrew and, oh, you surprised us with this number, because the numbers, they may not like it, and it may keep them from withdrawing. But these are not surprises. And so the idea of getting this policy in effect now is that it's not a surprise.
Yeah. Harvey, what was the outcome of the case with CalPERS? Where they were bankruptcy, or they were trying to, what was the outcome? Was it Stockton, or was some other, it was San Bernardino?
San Bernardino.
Well, you mean the bankruptcy, or the small district that withdrew and refused to pay, and CalPERS? CalPERS has a mechanism in their statute that allows them literally to reduce benefits if the employer refuses to pay. So they did trigger that for a small district down south, and that's still in litigation over that. But there is a very specific statute in the PERS law that allows them to proportionately reduce retiree benefits if they don't get the funding from the employer. And they did trigger that. We don't have that statute. We have other means in our statute that PERS does not have to collect from a recalcitrant employer. But that's what happened. The Stockton bankruptcy is a very different story. And they got hammered very badly by the bankruptcy judge in the Stockton bankruptcy case. But ultimately, the plan in Stockton, the bankruptcy plan that was confirmed by the court and upheld on appeal,
is air conditioning
reinstated the payments to CalPERS 100%. So they were not shorted in Stockton.
That's right. I remember that.
Same thing happened outside of a plan in San Bernardino. So to this date, there's been no Chapter 9 bankruptcy that has caused a disruption in the PERS benefits.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah. This concludes our discussion.
Any further questions or comments? Okay, thank you.
And this is an action item?
It is.
So I'm prepared to move the item, but it for the discussion earlier, and maybe I missed a step, is it wise to do kind of a first reading, second reading to allow employers an opportunity to weigh in on this? And I realize we've already done outreach, and I don't know how many, if any employers are in the room, but I'm prepared to move and vote for this, but I also would want, if there's any additional vetting that needs to take place amongst the employer group, I'm happy to include that in the motion.
I would be inclined to, in this case, not, because it is so fully spelled out in the memo, and I think if anyone was concerned, they would show up here to talk about it. I think it's fairly unlikely that this is going. We're going to have any of our employers. To me, it's a remote enough situation, so I'd be inclined to just say, let's just go ahead and do it.
I will make that my motion to adopt the policy as written.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any further discussion? All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Abstain? Motion passes.